Medical Matters.
17 minutes after 8 o'clock, I'm joined on the line by Professor Geeta Naidu, President of the South African Children's Study Cancer Group, the SACCSG. She joins me now on the line. Prof, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Good evening to you.
So September is the month dedicated to awareness around childhood cancer. Tell me why that's the case, Prof.
Okay. Well, we refer to it as GOM September, and it is a month that is celebrated internationally to raise awareness for childhood cancer. The history of this is that in 1997, a group of families who were impacted by childhood cancer decided to use the gold, the color gold, to represent the warriors and heroes facing this dreaded disease. And as we know, the color gold symbolizes hope and rejuvenation. And ever since then, the gold ribbon has become a representative of childhood cancer, and September is the month that is celebrated. Childhood cancer, fortunately, is not as prevalent as adult cancers, but the incidence is increasing more rapidly than adult cancers. And we feel it is imperative that we raise awareness of childhood cancer, which will translate into early diagnosis, which hopefully then means better overall survival of children with cancer.
Why is that the case, Prof? Why are we seeing an increased prevalence of childhood cancer?
Well, what causes childhood cancer is unknown, unlike adult cancers. Many adult cancers are lifestyle driven. But with childhood cancer, nobody really knows what causes childhood cancer. But because of the increasing in the numbers, there are many theories that are put forth. Could it be some viruses that we are unaware of? Are there chemicals that are the unborn child or young mother is exposed to? But we do not know. There's a small percentage of childhood cancers that may have a genetic component. But the reason we don't know, but there are some theories as to why, for example, in South Africa, the incidence may be increasing. I think for all this time, we have focused on communicable diseases, for example, TB, HIV, diarrheal diseases, respiratory diseases. And as our health care improved, and also we focused a lot on neonatal care. That's, you know, the newborn baby from the day they're born till they're 28 days old. And as those diseases, the outcome of these diseases are improving and children live longer, we have better access to antiretrovirals, more immunization, better nutrition, then I suppose those children who were dying may now live to develop these cancers.
Prof, in very broad terms, in terms that are accessible to somebody who is lay to your profession, that as I am, what is the reason for malignancy, for the occurrence of cancer in children or adults? What happens to cells that causes what we now know as cancer?
Yeah, okay. Well, when we talk about cell division and cell growth, there are many factors within our body that control how cells divide, how many times they divide, how rapidly or how slowly they divide. And we have genes that control this division process. So what happens with, for example, leukemia? We have the immature white blood cells that are produced in your bone marrow. And these cells may go through millions of cell divisions until a mature white cell is formed, and then it leaves the bone marrow to enter the bloodstream. For reasons unknown to us, there may be defects in how these cells divide. And the problem is that in nature, if there's a problem with a cell, you may see it even in your garden or with insects, that they die off. But unfortunately, if you're taking the disease of leukemia, that doesn't happen. The abnormal cell continues to proliferate and fill the bone marrow, and then goes beyond the bone marrow. So that's a very basic principle of what leukemia is.
And the mechanics of cancer would be the same in both children and adults?
Yes, they are, but the causes are different. In adults, we know it's maybe smoking, it's maybe obesity, it's alcohol, it's the consumption of red meat, it's multiple sexual partners. These are some of the causes that may lead to an increased incidence of certain types of cancers in adults. For children, no one knows it. For those children who are HIV infected, living with HIV, for those kids, we know that the HIV is what drives the malignant process. But other than that, we do not really know in children what causes cancer.
We'd love to take calls from you on 011-883-0702. If you're here in Johannesburg, if you're in Cape Town, the number to dial is 021-446-0567. As I speak to Professor Geeta Naidu, she is president of the South African Children's Study Cancer Group. And you may not know this, but September is a month dedicated to raising awareness around the very, very sad and very tragic issue of cancer in children. Would it be fair, Prof, for me to say that given the fact that we know so little about what causes cancer, particularly with children, that we are, as medical professionals, are really caught up in merely managing the disease and providing as much comfort as possible rather than perhaps dealing with it at a curative level?
Yes, I mean, the thing about childhood cancers as compared to adult cancers is that they're highly curable. So even though we do not know what causes these childhood cancers, we know that there are certain warning signs that may alert us to childhood cancer. The problem with childhood cancer is that people forget that this disease exists. So at our unit, I work at Chris Hani Baragwanath Academic Hospital. We have composed the warning signs of childhood cancer. These warning signs have been adopted by our National Department of Health and SIOP. SIOP is the International Organization of Childhood Cancer. And they have adopted these warning signs, and now these warning signs are being used in many, especially low and middle-income countries. So the idea is to alert primary care workers, either nurses or doctors, kindergarten, nursery school teachers, parents, about what the early warning signs of childhood cancer are. The problem is that these cancers are not picked up. So children present with advanced disease. When you have advanced disease, you need so much more therapy to cure the child. So the therapy in itself poses problems. So children may actually die as complications of the treatment as opposed to the cancer itself. And this is why we feel when we talk about awareness of childhood cancer, we want to raise the awareness of childhood cancer in the general population. So the warning signs that we have developed in our unit is what we refer to as the St. Silouan warning signs. St. Silouan was a monk who prayed on Mount Athos. And the Silouan is a mnemonic. The S stands for seek medical help early. The I refers to the eye.
Yeah.
And so we should be alert for a new squint, a bulging eye, either one eye or both eyes, a sudden decrease in vision. The L stands for a lump, and a lump anywhere in the body. This could be painful or it could be not painful. So these lumps can be in the arms, in the legs, in the face, in the jaw, in the neck, in the abdomen. Difficult to pick it up if it's within the chest cavity. But any lump that is growing is of concern. The U stands for unexplained fever, not responding to antibiotics, unexplained loss of weight, loss of appetite, pallor in these children, bleeding. And the A stands for aching joints.
Prof, I'm losing you. I'm losing you. I don't know whether it has something to do with my side of the connection.
Can you
or
hear
yours.
Me now?
I can hear you. I can hear you loud and clear now. All right.
Okay.
So
A stands for aching bones.
Yes.
And the N stands for neurological signs.
Right. So, are there any, you know, with that menu of signs that caregivers and parents and I suppose the medical field needs to be looking out for, are there any specific types of cancers that are more prevalent in our country, for example, than others?
Yes. In South Africa, well, firstly, when we look at childhood cancers, we divide them into two groups, the solid tumors and the blood cancers. So in South Africa, the two most common blood cancers are leukemias and lymphomas in children. And the solid tumors is brain tumors, eye tumors, kidney tumors, muscle tumors, and sarcomas. Those are the most common tumors that we are seeing. They're not really so different from what high-income countries have as their top cancers.
And how young does this go? I mean, what's the youngest age that a child can be diagnosed with cancer?
Yeah, this may be quite surprising. We have children born with cancer.
Oh, my word.
Yes, not as commonly as the slightly older child. So often when we talk about cancer, it's children from the age of two. But there are some cancers we will see in the early child, in the young child. For example, the eye cancer. That's in the very early young child. The liver cancers I see in very early. Children with Down syndrome may present very early in their life with leukemias. So it's a disease that spans, I mean, these are probably acquired intrauterine.
And would that be because mom has something that she's passed on to the child, perhaps? Or is it something that happens completely independently of mom?
Most times, I would say 95% of the time, independent of the mum. There are various factors that people have looked at. Parental smoking, drug exposure, infections. But none of these, as I said, we have definite evidence for. So these are just fetal, embryonal changes that happen. And a lot of these tumors are actually embryonal tumors that we see in children.
You know, Doc, one of the things that I've come to know when talking about cancer is the sheer agony and pain that sufferers of cancer have to deal with. Is it true for children too?
Absolutely, absolutely. The difficulty is that children cannot express their pain.
Oh my, yeah.
So they just cry a lot, they're very unhappy, they may not eat, they're vomiting a lot. But so it's very, very important for us to pay attention to pain and to have good pain medication, to have good palliative care. So this is very important that we pay attention to this because young children cannot express or verbalize their pain. Yes.
And I imagine that because a child is unable to verbalize and express their pain, for parents or caregivers that are not educated in the matter, it becomes very frustrating, and that may add on to, I suppose, the general discomfort brought on by the situation, including the pain that the child is going through.
Reasons why our parents experience a lot of stress. For example, in my hospital, Chris Hani Baragwanath, as you may know, it's the third largest hospital in the world. There are very few treating cancer centers in South Africa. So we have a very, very wide referral area. So parents have to travel very wide, long distances to get to the hospital. Once the child is in the hospital, they have to return home to look after their other children. Mm. Many of them may be employed in the informal sector, so they do not have the luxury of parental responsibility leave or anything like that. So there are many, many stressful factors. The cost of transport to the hospital is expensive, and should they lose a day of work, who feeds the children at home? So, you know, besides the child with the cancer and their pain and the fact that this child may die, the fact that you have to leave the child so far away from you, that's just one part of this complex problem. The mothers themselves are unfortunately not very well educated. Unemployment levels are high. There's AIDS, there's tuberculosis. Many of them are single mothers. So it's just a very huge, complex problem for the parents of our children with cancer.
011-883-0702 is the number to dial if you are here in Johannesburg. If you're in Cape Town, the number is 021-446-0567. My guest is Professor Geeta Naidu, and she's president of the South African Children's Study Cancer Group. We're talking about cancer in children, and it is perhaps more prevalent than what we thought it might be. How are we dealing, therefore, with all of these complexities, these stresses, Professor Naidu? And I want to perhaps add another element to all of this. In the time of COVID-19, what are we experiencing? How are we dealing with it? Just in terms of the education for parents and caregivers whose children are suffering from cancer, how are we dealing with all of this?
Yes, our already fragile African healthcare systems have really been tested during COVID-19. And for example, in our hospital, we have two wards. And we have one ward with children who we suspect have COVID and those who we know definitely have COVID. And we have another ward where we've tested them and they are negative. The problem is now, and this is a huge stressor for our children and for our nurses as well, that the parents have not been allowed into the wards. And that's understandable because the parents are traveling to and fro in their homes. Social distancing is really not possible. They're using public transport to get to us. So obviously their exposure to COVID is so much more than, you know, than other people. So we've had to, as difficult as it is, we've had to actually not allow the parents into the hospital. Sure. And this has been really, really, really tough for the nurses, for the doctors, and for the children. And especially for children who may actually, we know they are not going to survive the cancer. Some of them have just had their moms and dads with them for a few hours before they died.
Oh, and, doctor, I mean, this is such a... It's a heartbreaking story. I mean,
Oh
my word! And so of course during the COVID-19 period, as you say, parents were refused access to these children.
Yeah, well, sort of refused, but understandably so.
Sure, of course.
The hospital had to make this decision. We knew how cruel it is, but we had to protect the children in the hospital that they were not infected. We had to protect the nursing staff especially, that they do not take this back to their homes. Our nurses... up to their children and their elderly parents.
Indeed.
So, yeah, no, it's been really, really...
All right, I've got a question from a listener on our 702 line, Prof. My guest, or my listener says, Aubrey, ask your guest, what is teratogens? I don't know, is teratogens or teratogens? Is that
teratogens.
Not? Yeah, is that not the cause of cancer in children? Asks this listener.
Well, let me say something is teratogenic. It means that it can cause deformities in a child, not necessarily cancer.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So, and that can be many. It could be viruses, it could be genetic factors, it could be environmental exposure, certain chemicals, pesticides.
What are teratogens? What is that? I hear you saying that something is teratogenous. I think it's an adjective for what happens, but what is that?
Teratogenic, it means that will cause some deformity.
Okay.
It could be cancer, it could be other deformities, spinal cord deformities, brain deformities, lung, heart deformities.
Okay, so Prof, one of the things that I thought was quite progressive is the fact that you have started a program or an initiative to try and document the signs for potential cancer patients in children. If possible, if you could just run through those again, but what is the process that parents, caregivers should follow if they suspect something like this? Do they come out to parents? I'm thinking now of, schools, creches, for example, or what do they call them? Early childhood development centers. That's the word now. What do they do? Do they simply come out and say, listen, I was listening to the show yesterday and I'm seeing some of these symptoms, go get your child. What do you do? What are the processes?
Yes, what they should do is go to their nearest clinic. And then there's referral pathways to get to us. The other thing that they can do is to contact CHOC. CHOC is the Children's Hematology Oncology Clinic, and they are our partners. And they also have referral systems, and they're also disseminating the warning signs. The most important thing is to go to your clinic or to go to your GP and have the child examined.
And how sensitive are medical staff to the possibility of childhood cancers? I mean, if I go to my local clinic in Mamelodi, would that be something that would be uppermost in a health practitioner's mind? In other words, I'm asking, are there instances where parents have gone to a clinic multiple times because the diagnosis just didn't go in the direction, in the mind of the health practitioner, just didn't go in the direction perhaps of childhood cancer?
Yes, you are absolutely correct. This is the problem, and this is why we are trying to improve the education of our medical students, of our nurses, of our pediatricians, because not only in South Africa, but all over the world, childhood cancer the diagnosis is often delayed. We have done a study in the
I'm losing you again, Prof. If you could just move around just a little bit. These things do happen now and again. Yeah, I can hear you now. Loud and clear. Go ahead.
So we've done a study in our unit looking at cancer of the eye. And we've looked at when does a mother first notice that there's something wrong with the child's eye? When does she seek help? And once she has been to a primary health care service or her GP, what is the time difference between her noticing something wrong and her going to the doctor? And what is the time difference between the doctor referring the patient to a unit like my unit? So from the mother noticing the sign to seeking help, it's 4 weeks. And to me, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
The father may not be at home. He may be working. He may return home at the end of the month with the money to take the child to the doctor. So that's 4 weeks, and that's well understood. From the time a primary health care doctor has seen this child, or a primary health care nurse, until the child ends up in my unit, we have calculated is 10 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was 15 years ago was 10 months, and we've looked at an audit again recently, and it is now down to 6 months. So we think that our warning signs is working, it is helping, but we still need to do a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
So we really need the word to be spread.
So more than 80% of South Africa's population's default go to medical assistance is traditional indigenous health practitioners. To what extent are they being taught, made aware of this prevalence of childhood cancer? Is that conversation taking place?
Yes, we do. We reach out to them as well, and we have tried to educate them. And if I get a child in my ward, and I know that the family has been to a traditional health practitioner, I ask them to invite him into my ward.
Right.
So that we can speak and we can discuss.
Yeah.
And then I would say, listen, give me a chance now. And I'm happy for you to pray for the child. I'm happy for you to comfort the family. I'm happy for you to visit the child. Just give me a chance. So I think by...
I'm losing the professor once again. Prof, this is so critical. If you can just once again move around. Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I believe by including the traditional health practitioners, by including the nurse, the primary school teachers, the religious leaders, it helps me to get the parents to improve the compliance with the treatment that we can offer. Because one of the big problems in low and middle income countries is treatment abandonment.
Yeah. And of course, so many reasons can be there for that abandonment.
Yes, it's the distance away from
for
the hospital.
Sure.
It's the cost of transport.
Yeah.
It's the maternal educational level. Many factors have looked into, and it's not just one factor that we can fix overnight. If it was so easy, we would do it.
Prof, talk to me about the professionals, the pediatricians, the nurses, the pediatric oncologists that must deal with this reality on a day-to-day basis. How do they recuperate? I'm just listening to this conversation, and I need 6 weeks leave. how do you as professionals, and I understand you're professionals, that's part of what you're trained for, but I can imagine looking into the eyes of a 2-3 year old who is in who's suffering from pain, who's unable to express themselves, and you know what's going on with the child. How do you deal with it as professionals?
Yes, it is extremely, it is a very, very painful, it's very painful to deal with these children. In the young child, it is more the parent. Because the child doesn't really know what's going on. I have a large group of teenagers. We treat up to 19 years of age. And I find them to be the most difficult group to deal with. Today, I have a 15-year-old boy who is a wonderful boy, highly intelligent. He knows everything about his disease. He's 4 months away from completion, and today he relapsed.
Oh, my word.
And it was a terrible day for the entire staff, for the nurses, for the administrative staff, and for the young doctors, and even for myself. It was just an absolutely terrible day because we had to tell him what was going on.
I'd like to invite a number of listeners, or maybe when I say a number of categories of listeners. I'd like to invite listeners that are in the traditional healthcare sector who perhaps have come to, come into contact with childhood cancer. How do they deal with it? What is the process that they follow? I'd love to hear from nurses and doctors who are pediatricians or who operate in that space. What are some of your challenges? Please give us a call as we raise awareness about childhood cancer together with Professor Geeta Naidu, president of the South African Children's Study Cancer Group. I'd love to hear from you, your experience. What do you experience on a day-to-day basis in your profession? What do you do? How do you make sure that you don't miss the right diagnosis for childhood cancer? Because as you said, Prof, one of the biggest issues at the moment is the misdiagnosis of this. What typically happens? Does a parent go after being diagnosed with one or other disease and then find that nothing is helping in terms of the medication that they've been given and then come many times? Is that what happens?
Yes, I think a mother may be concerned about a child, go to the clinic, and the clinic may not take the mother too seriously. She then believes the clinic that there's nothing too seriously wrong with her child. 2 months later, she may think that the problem's getting worse. She may go to another hospital. So this is the problem. I mean, it's difficult. Mothers may not have money to go to the hospital every week, to go to the clinic every week. So, and when they go to the clinics, I think people are not thinking about childhood cancer. And when we did an audit of our patients, at least 64% of our solid tumors came to us as advanced disease.
Yeah. And I would imagine that has some very grave implications for the levels of trust of... trust in the medical system, I would imagine. If a mom has been bringing their child to the clinic a number of times, the staff at the clinic have not been able to diagnose, not because they are incompetent, it's just that maybe their vigilance isn't sensitized to the idea of childhood cancer. I imagine that the confidence in the health system by the parent is seriously eroded.
Yes, but that's only one of the factors why children present with advanced disease. Many children may not have easy access to healthcare. So that's another reason why a mother may then take a child with advanced disease. For example, if a child has a mass in the abdomen, be it in the kidney or in the liver, I mean, the abdomen can grow quite a lot until the mother can actually pick up the mass.
Sure, doctor. Oh, 11883-0702-021-446-0567. One of the things that I've taken away from this conversation is that we do have a very strong focus on communicable diseases, and perhaps that's part of the reason why our focus tends to be so strong in that direction, and sometimes we misdiagnose childhood cancer and perhaps even other cancers that involve adults. What are the main issues that we should be taking away from this conversation, Prof?
I think it's a very complex thing. There's so many ramifications to this. And I think the most important thing for me is early diagnosis of the cancer. And it's not just the healthcare workers that are responsible for the delayed diagnosis. It's not parents in rural areas not having easy access, those parents who may go to traditional healers who may not understand childhood cancer, the poverty that many parents face. I mean, they'd rather buy a family a meal, that money as transport to take the hospital. So for me, it is really about early diagnosis. And as you said earlier, the country has emphasized communicable diseases. The Department of Health has now tasked me with writing a national children's cancer care plan. And I'm hoping that with this document and the early warning signs, so we have 13 children's cancer units in South Africa. And we had a workshop last month with the 13 public hospitals, were all attached to academic units. And we had this together with the World Health Organization, our Department of Health, and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in the U.S. They're the largest children's cancer research hospital in the world. And we had a very, very good workshop. And we have come up with certain criteria that we will now put into place. And hopefully in 2 years' time, we will have another workshop with the same group of people to see what changes we've been able to bring about and how is this impacting on earlier diagnosis of childhood cancer.
What is being done, Prof, just in terms of heightening the sensitivity to childhood cancer at an institutional level, both for the private and public sector? I would imagine that the same sort of mistakes, shall I call them mistakes, but the same sort of mistakes are to be found in the misdiagnosis of childhood cancer in both private and public sector healthcare. Is there something happening at an institutional level? Is government aware enough and sensitive enough to understand that this is something that needs to be a concerted teaching effort just in raising awareness about the paradigm shift that needs to incorporate non-communicable diseases such as childhood cancer?
Yes, well, as I said, we are emphasizing the teaching to undergraduate students. We are emphasizing childhood cancer. We teach them about this to those training to be pediatricians. And we have a very strong fellowship program where we are training the pediatricians in pediatric oncology. But we are also extending our training to outside South Africa. So that's the one thing that we're doing. Then we have organizations like CHOC and the National Department of Health, who are really trying to disseminate these warning signs for childhood cancer. Unfortunately, COVID came along, and a lot of that program has been disrupted. But we are hoping that we can still go on and go on with this program. And hopefully with our workshop that we had last month, we want to implement a lot of the suggestions that came up from this workshop, and perhaps in 2 years' time, we will have another workshop to be able to quantify whether we made any progress in improving the early diagnosis, which will then obviously translate into improved overall survival for childhood cancer.
You know, sometimes we know of certain, and this is the harsh reality of the world we live in, but we know of the existence of issues such as what we've been talking about for almost an hour, Prof. And somebody will say, yeah, we know about it, but it isn't big enough, Aubrey. It isn't big enough to attract the money. It isn't big enough. The problem isn't big enough to attract the money and the attention of decision makers in order to inspire and facilitate the kinds of programs you and I have been talking about. How big is this? Is the problem of the misdiagnosis of childhood cancer, Prof? And is it big? And I know this is going to sound almost inappropriate, but is it big and sexy enough to attract the attention of those with deep pockets and people who are able to make decisions?
You see, the thing is that, as I said right at the beginning of our conversation, it is a relatively rare disease compared to adult cancer.
Right.
But the increase in childhood cancer is greater than that at the moment of adult cancers. But still the numbers are not large enough, and this has been something that has been lamented by the pediatric oncology community across the world, that because it is not a large disease, a large number of people, it's children who are affected, that we have not been having these large supporting research. And in South Africa, one of the biggest problems is that we are so short-staffed, we are so understaffed, that at the end of the day, you're working long, long hours just performing your clinical duty, and for us in the academic hospitals, teaching undergraduates and postgraduates, that the funding and the time for research is what we need. We actually need protected time for research, and we need the funding to carry out this research. Because a lot of what we're doing now is based on the research that comes from high-income countries, from America and from Europe. But our epidemiological patterns are different. We need to do the research here for our patients.
Yeah, yeah.
To improve the outcomes for our patients.
Look, this conversation for me is probably one of the hardest medical matters conversations I've had in a very long time. And I suppose it has to do with the fact that it's children that are the victims of cancer in this particular case. What would it take, do you think, Prof, besides conversations like this on radio, to really shake society at the core? And by society, I'm sort of implying, the big corporates, the government, and you know, all of those decision makers and deep-pocketed people to be able to assist in assisting you in this. What do you think it would take beyond just these kinds of conversations? Professor Naidu? Oh, it looks like I've lost Professor Naidu.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you go. What do you think? Yeah, I can hear you now. What do you think it would take, Prof?
Yeah. So I mentioned St. Jude's Research Hospital in the U.S.
Yeah.
That hospital is run solely by public funding. And their budget is $2.7 million U.S. dollars a day. So all of this money is into treating their children and the research.
Yeah. Professor,
if you are in the U.S., you will see every radio station, every newspaper, every TV channel has an advert for St. Jude's Research Hospital.
Yeah.
Egypt has a hospital that is, the name of the hospital is a bank account. The poorest of poor will donate one Egyptian dollar into this account. And they have developed an outstanding world-class pediatric oncology unit. So what we need here is we need the awareness and we need the funding.
Prof, how do people follow you? How do people follow you?
Sorry,
How do people follow you, either as an individual, as Professor Geeta Naidu, or perhaps the South African Children's Study Cancer Group?
Yes, if you go Google us, you will find us, or CHOC, one of the two, and a lot of fundraising comes from there.
Professor Geeta Naidu, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and the work that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Professor Geeta Naidu. Good evening to you.